Welcome to This Week in Money. I'm Jim Goddard. Today, Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com runs down the major markets. The stock markets had a fairly positive week after a correction in December. It's been a good market for gold, and crude is showing some buying opportunities. Ross also checks out the U.S. and Canadian dollars. Editor of Rick's Picks, Rick Ackerman, checks in from Florida to chat about Bitcoin, the U.S. dollar, and exploding Pyrex. He also has a special offer for our listeners. One of Canada's top real estate agents, Alan Mark Angel, talks about high-end real estate in Canada's priciest market, West Vancouver. He says condo sales in BC have really picked up, and he's optimistic for the general real estate market for the rest of the year. We'll talk to Ross Clark right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com. Welcome to This Week in Money, the source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com, where you'll find insightful market commentary and timely technical analysis. You can find him on X at Charts by Ross. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Good to be back, Jim.
How would you describe what happened on the stock markets this week?
Well, this was a fairly positive week. You know, we started off at the end of last week at the bottom of what was the deepest correction in quite a while. You know, we had topped out here in the middle of December, and by the time we got into the end of last week, we had been S&P had dropped from 6,100 down to 5,800, so pretty sizable decline. Got some good oversold signals, especially in the NASDAQ there, and so the NASDAQ and the S&P right back to the old highs. The Dow's had a pretty good run, but the transports, interestingly enough, have only retraced just a little over half of the decline. So a bit of divergence starting to show in there, and especially, you know, if we look at the broader side of things with things like the advanced decline line, that one is having real trouble coming back. So definitely got some divergence starting to show in. And, we're in the middle of earnings season at this point, so every day is a little bit of a knee-jerk reaction up or down for individual stocks. But the key levels remain like the 20-week moving average as far as the S&P is concerned. And from that perspective, you know, you're looking at something around the 5,900 to, you know, let's call it 5,900 level as far as the S&P is concerned on the cash price. If we break there, then you're looking at a pretty good chance of a correction into the next couple of months.
What's going on with gold?
Good market for gold. It's been steadily moving pretty much for the last, 5 or 6 days now. We're back spot price up to $2,774 to finish off the week. That's the highest close in months and months now. We've come from a good pullback down to about 2,600 in December, and at this point, you know, we've got, if you take a look at it on a short-term basis, there had been resistance up around 2,725. So we've popped through there. I would think that that's the important level to be looking at now, not the lower levels for support. I think that 2,725, you want to make sure that that holds on any minor corrections in here. And, you take it step by step. The gold market's been doing this pretty much on its own. Silver has been really the laggard. And the stocks, anything there, you take a look into individual stocks or items like the GDXJ ETF, now still failing well below the the interim highs that we saw early December and a long way from the levels that we saw at the end of October. So miners are still having trouble, and it's going to take a while, I think, either to have some pretty much exponential move in as far as the gold's concerned to get the miners up and going right now.
What's happening with crude?
Crude, we got a nice sell signal up here at $80, and this week we're seeing a good correction. We're down to the 20-day moving average, and the optimum here, when you come off a low in crude, the early part of the run, once you've got overbought and start to roll over like we have right now, that first correction back to the 50-day moving average, which right now is around $73, you want to be looking for an oversold reading as you get down in and approach that. And we're very close to that. I would say any follow-through next week on the downside, you're really going to be into a really good buying range. You say down from 80 down to 73, it's a nice time to be looking to step back in. And if anything, when you take a look at the oil stocks, the sector, unlike precious metals where the stocks have been having trouble, we take a look at the energy stocks, they had an excellent recovery on the upside. We went from a capitulation low down around 83 on the XLE in December. We got up to 94 at the early part of this week, and we only pulled back to about 91.5. So giving back maybe 10 or 15% of the rally off the low. So that's holding in exceptionally well. So if we get a good oversold as far as the crude oil is concerned, I would think the stocks have a chance to make a nice run on the upside.
What's happening with the U.S. and Canadian dollars?
I've been watching for an important top here as we came out of December into January. Got all of the upside counts that we would look for here. The daily, weekly, and monthly counts all came to fruition, and we've seen the rollover. So the first thing to be watching for was the move through the 20-day moving average. That occurred at the beginning of the week. We've got really good follow-through on the downside to close off the week. And so, you know, we've gone from 110 down to 107.5 on the index. We're at the 50-day moving average. Probably sees a bounce out of here. But, you know, overall, it would appear that, that this is a good, important top in place now for the dollar index. I think you get back down into maybe the 105 range. With that, you look at the other currencies. The euro has had just a great week here. It's one of its best weeks in months and months. The other one, which has had some life but not doing as well as you would hope for, is the Canadian dollar. I guess that we've got the Bank of Canada next week probably going to do another quarter point drop as far as the bank rate is concerned there. And you've still got this huge overhanging question of tariffs with the U.S., And who knows what that's going to be like. You know, we'll be talking a week from now. We probably still won't have heard anything definitive. So I think there's still reason for the Canadian dollar to be, oversold, but not in the position where you can have a major rally. I think it could be, we're here at 69.70 to finish off the week. Probably got resistance up around the 71, 71.5, but I think that's about all I would look for on the near term for the Canadian dollar.
Ross, thank you so much for the update.
Pleasure to be with you, Jim.
My guest has been Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com. Find him on X at Charts by Ross. Coming up, Rick Ackerman next on This Week in Money.
Always consult your investment professional before making any investment decision. This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Rick Ackerman, editor of the newsletter Rick's Picks. His website is rickackerman.com. He's speaking to us from South Florida. Welcome back to the show. And of course, Florida got snow. Were you in the snow zone?
Thanks for inviting me on, as always, Jim. It's not exactly snowing here, but we've had a pretty crummy week for anybody who wanted to go to the beach or play golf. It's been a cooler than normal winter so far. Winter, of course, is our season.
You have a special offer for our listeners. It's free for 2 weeks. Can you tell us about it?
Very special indeed. No credit card necessary. Just click and you're instantly gaining access to a great chat room. Attracts traders from around the world. A lot of good, timely ideas in there. And you'll have access to the front page, which is tradable, what I call touts. They're widely followed vehicles that are popular for traders. Gold, silver, Bitcoin, crude oil, even the S&Ps. And anyway, just it's a lot of fun, except for today, kind of turgid today. But anyway, the trial subscription is no obligation and no credit card necessary.
Let's talk about Bitcoin, the U.S. dollar, and optimization. First, I think you have a lot to say about this. Is Bitcoin a good value play?
Well, before I say anything, I want to mention that I do track Bitcoin for trading purposes. We had yesterday, I would call it kind of a perfect trade with catching a nice low, getting out 0.0009% off the top of the move. And so Bitcoin is very easy to trade. The system I use is particularly good with violent, volatile vehicles. They're very easy to figure out. So having said that, and I don't have any problem with people out there just trading Bitcoin like crazy and making some money at it, but I draw the line at saying that Bitcoin is actually worth anything. It's not, and I haven't heard a single good argument. In fact, not only have I not heard a good argument as to why Bitcoin should be worth anything or why it should be money, but I haven't heard any argument that sounded other than stupid. You know, the argument that seems to be made most often is scarcity, that the original mintage of Satoshis was 21 million, but scarcity it's not an argument as to why anything should be a store of value, especially something that has no value. And people say, oh yeah, well, the dollar is worthless too. And I would tend to agree. The dollar is really a debt instrument, but I don't think it deserves to be characterized compared with something that was literally conjured up out of thin air.
Technically, how does Bitcoin work and does it make sense?
How does it work and does it make sense? It makes sense, really, because it evolved out of something called the blockchain. And the blockchain has some value to the extent that it can record effect and record a transaction securely. And I would say that gives Bitcoin some value, but I would estimate the value more on the order of $2 to $3 rather than $109,000. So, but blockchain technology is very useful. It could potentially do a lot of things beyond just creating fake money. It could, you know, you can keep your medical records encoded within the blockchain. And the whole idea is that when a transaction is done with Bitcoin, in order to insert that transaction to the blockchain, sort of lock it in so that nobody can tamper with it or remove it, the way of doing that is to solve an algorithm. And all the people who are out there, quote unquote, mining Bitcoin, they're using computer power to solve an algorithm that will place the transaction within the blockchain so that nobody can ever tamper with it. So that's how it works. And it takes, as we get closer and closer to the limit supposedly imposed on Bitcoin by Satoshi, or nobody knows who, really. There's a lot of speculation as to who the originator of Bitcoin was. But as we get closer to that $21 million limit, it takes more computational power to solve the puzzle that extends the Bitcoin by one more unit. So so it takes an enormous amount of power, and I don't know where we're going to get all the power that we need for digital activity, which seems to have replaced real work, real things, real goods, real objects in the economy. So we're an information-based economy, for better or worse. I think we'll find out where that all leads, that we're no longer making things other than digital things. So any case, even the demands of computer processing are growing exponentially, and we have people like Zuckerberg saying he wants to build his own nuclear plant just to run a lot of computers. So, but I digress.
Would investing in utility stocks be as a hedge as they have to power up all these AI data centers to power Bitcoin and other cryptos?
I don't know about that. You know, the utilities will always be regulated in a way where they'll make money, but more power may be generated by private operators just jumping the gun. I mean, if Musk can build spaceships, then entrepreneurs can build power plants. And of course, the best way to do that with current technology would be to use some of the modular nuclear generators.
And isn't Microsoft behind the firing up again of Three Mile Island for atomic power?
Microsoft's kind of behind everything. You know, it never ceases to amaze me what Bill Gates owns, but I don't know that specifically. I know I was not too long ago visiting the Three Mile Island plant. I was just taking a hike in the that part of Pennsylvania. But anyway, yeah, somehow we'll come up with the power, and it's probably going to have to be nuclear.
How does Bitcoin compare to other cryptos?
Well, it's sort of the top dog, and anybody who observed Bitcoin over some of the wilder swings, we had one episode where Bitcoin went from, at the time, it was the all-time high around $70,000, went down into the, I think, maybe low teens. And when it crashed, there were a couple thousand different flavors of boutique cryptocurrencies, and they all were linked to Bitcoin. And when Bitcoin lost complete credibility, or completely lost credibility for a while there, all of the boutique cryptocurrencies had no value at all. You couldn't exchange them. I know, because I bought $3,000 worth of crap coin myself just to see how they work the various crypto scams. And so I got to sort of follow my money and come in initially on a hustle that promised that if you just left your money parked in crap coin for, I think it was 18 months, you would double or triple your money or some such, or maybe it was park it for 3 years and you'll triple your money. But that was a fraud, because you weren't tripling your money. You were simply tripling the crap coin in your account. And you couldn't even exchange crap coin for cash. You had to exchange it for a more fungible kind of crypto, like Ethereum. You had to trade it for Ethereum and then trade the Ethereum for dollars. And I have to say that this particular scheme, and believe me, I'm not naming them because I don't want to expose myself legally, or I would just mention who it was, but I can't even remember the name of their crap coin, but it was a bunch of young Asian billionaires with a pretty good hustle. And of course, some of the early adopters did manage to cash out enough to buy new cars and things like that. And they were kind of trotted out at, there was a big party in South Beach, Miami, and the cryptos, not even the zillionaires, these were kind of local regional guys who in this Tupperware scheme of things had made enough money that they could be used to induce other people to invest. So they had a big blowout at a Miami Beach nightclub, and the food was terrific, dance, music, everything. I won a raffle and got, I think, $1,000 more crap coin, which I had earmarked for my sons. But, you know, when Bitcoin collapsed, it was all worthless.
Could the same thing happen again?
It will happen again. Mm-hmm. It can't not happen again. And I have to say, to give the thieving young Asian billionaires their due, they were very smart, because when Crapcoin crashed, there was a vacuum. You couldn't find out from the company, like, well, what was going to happen to the 10,000 or 20,000 or whatever that I had invested. There was not a word out of them. But when Bitcoin itself looked like it was bottoming and might turn around, the thieving young Asian billionaires put out some cryptic emails about, you know, hey, don't worry, you're all going to get your money back. And what that meant was that the thieving young Asian billionaires were saying, hey, look, we've got all the names, addresses, contact information for 15,000 suckers who came aboard with us. Let's not dump that. I mean, it's worth money to us. If Cryptoin, Bitcoin ever comes back, we can simply suck in these same rubes all over again. So they did. And it was because they had faith and because they had that thieving intelligence that says, look, let's keep this scam alive, that they were eventually able to put out more specific emails about, hey, here's what you got to do. And in order for me to have converted my $3,000 worth of worthless crap coin into their new cryptocurrency, all I had to do was fill out about 700 pages of information and give them every detail about my background, my financial data, and all that. And I'd be signed up for whatever the new venture was going to be when it got rolling. And it was too much for me. I told the Tupperware lady who ostensibly recruited me into this scam, I said, I'll tell you what, you do the paperwork, I'll give you half of whatever you recover. But she didn't take me up on it.
Have you bought cryptos?
Well, just in that way. Yeah. And I don't remember the name. It was not Dogecoin or Crapcoin, but it was just something worthless. And I have to say that the young thieving Asian billionaires, that they were very clever about the wording. You know, when you use certain words and say people are going to triple their money, they were very careful to not use the word interest-bearing, like you're making interest. Hmm. It was more like you were getting bonus points on your collection of gold stamps. And so they were very, 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 very careful about using language that would not incur the interest of banking regulators. So all the words were kind of special to this particular scam. They ran a scam without ever saying it was a banking thing that was going to earn you interest or whatever. And it was very educational for me to see how they got around the scrutiny of regulators.
Would you buy cryptos again to further investigate?
No, because I know how the scam works and I know it's worthless. And I guess there's no, and it's fine. I think if people want to jump in and try to make a little money, that's fine. As long as they understand what they're doing, it's cryptocurrency. Bitcoin is worthless and it's eventually going to find its way back to worthless.
Well,
how do you know you're actually investing in something legitimate? Because I know of at least two people who lost loads of money because the so-called Bitcoin people weren't real. They were getting reports every day showing how their crypto was going up in value. When they asked for it, there was no one there. Well, how do you know it's a legit investment?
Well, you really don't. And it's the funny thing about crypto, nobody uses it to buy stuff. It's even though, yes, you can affect a transaction with Bitcoin, Bitcoin or whatever, who the hell wants to do that? I mean, it's just too much bother. And you don't know. There are a couple ironies. One, when you see crypto promoted, they always show you it's a solid gold token. It makes you, there are some crypto idiots out there who, of course, talk about how they would trade their gold for crypto because crypto is just better. And I say, go ahead, trade it all. But another, it's just ironic that crypto should be promoted with an image of a gold token, which, of course, I don't know that such a thing even exists. But as far, and another irony is that one of the advantages ascribed to Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies is that they're encoded. Nobody can crack the code. Of course, AI will eventually crack the code. But crypto is supposedly secure currency because it's so hard certainly the blockchain is almost impenetrable. But nobody does it that way. There's 100 other ways to steal Bitcoin, and usually there are ways that kind of leverage the stupidity of people who own them. They have their own code simply to get into their crypto wallets or whatever they use to speculate in cryptocurrencies. And so they for all the claims made about how secure the blockchain is, there's 100 other ways to steal Bitcoin, and we've seen enormous amounts of it stolen in the tens of billions of dollars. I just think it's funny that it should work out that way, that crypto is it's not only insecure, but it's just a great, the cryptocurrency and the internet were made for each other. You know, anybody, if you've been noticing over the last 20 years, the internet is just one giant crime wave. There's probably more criminal activity and pornographers active on the web than anything else. It's a perfect medium, and there's almost no such thing as a legitimate sale taking place on Craigslist. You know, you're lucky if you don't get raped or murdered by whoever comes to buy stuff from you. So the internet was just, it was just waiting to happen to facilitate criminal opportunity that was inaccessible to people before. You know, there was a time really when you had to go in and rob a bank. And I think after a while, it started to sink in. The average haul on a bank job was $8,000. And here with cryptocurrency, you don't even have to leave the house and you can steal 10 times that. So the internet tied to cryptocurrencies, it's a perfect vehicle for crime.
Do you think cryptos have a greater fool component?
Well, yeah. I mean, it used to be able to buy them for 9 cents or whatever it was. And now you got to pay $109,000. There's probably there were a few fools in the bidding war there. And incidentally, I think it's Bitcoin is at or near a top, and I'm definitely not one of those. Even though it's all just craziness and stupidity and speculative mania, I still think we're closer to a top now than anybody who's guessing it's going to 500,000 or a million or, you know, 10 million or whatever the popular number of the day is.
Are cryptos used for money laundering even though they leave a digital footprint?
No, I think that's not a major use, because it's really when you move crypto around borders, past borders, you attract the attention of people, you know, regulators who were charged with trying to find a way to block these currency flows. So you get right in the way of the law enforcement apparatus, and that's probably the last thing you want to do with crypto is you move huge sums. But that said, it's a pretty good way. If you feel like you don't want to get on an airplane with a suitcase full of $100 bills or whatever, it is easier to move them, to do a crypto transaction. But then, of course, you're setting up two accounts, and that's at some point maybe going to attract the wrong kind of attention. Wrong if you're a criminal minded. So anyway, I wouldn't depend on crypto to secure a criminal operation to make all the transactions invisible. They're very visible.
Some people are predicting the U.S. dollar reserve currency will be replaced by another currency, or that the U.S. dollar will become digital. Could the U.S. dollar actually collapse?
What a joke, really. Just when those people say the dollar is going to be replaced by some other currency, ask them to name that other currency. You know, it's not like the Chinese want the yuan to be the reserve currency. Nobody wants it, really. And the dollar has sort of responsibility has fallen on the dollar. It's mostly a burden. The seigniorage part of it, where essentially everybody pays you for the use of your money, is a good thing. It's a net positive for U.S. cash flow, but of course insignificant compared to the $36 trillion of flow that's not even there. All right, so. So in any case, you know, you run the dollar's locked in. There's nothing that can take the dollar's place in the chief business of planet Earth, which is shuffling paper. You know, most of the money is made shuffling paper, leveraging financial assets. That's the business of planet Earth. You know, if you compare it with, and it's a $2 quadrillion plus business. That's the sum total of derivatives. And don't settle for the nominal value, or people who say, well, some things are counted twice, whether they're counted two times or five times or 12 times, somebody's counting on them as an asset. It sits as an asset on a ledger, and all $2.5 quadrillion of it represents a potential deflationary force. That's all it is. So we've got this $2.5 quadrillion market of bullshit, you know, just financial instruments. And when you measure that against global GDP, namely real stuff that we produce, and we'll even throw services in there, even though we know a lot of services are just a joke, that's you're talking about $200 trillion. So you've got this $2.5 quadrillion financial edifice that is working nominally in the service of a global economy that only outputs $200 trillion worth of goods. So you tell me, you know, what is the business, the main business of the planet? It's just wheeling and dealing in financial instruments. So you can't replace that with another currency. You can't segue out of dollars and put that whole market into some God forbid digital currency. That's even more worthless than the dollar. So no, we're all stuck with dollars. And one thing else that's not incidental is the whole world is pretty gung ho about being able to pay for real stuff like oil in a kind of money, dollars, that's an infinite supply. So we really, if we had to pay gold bullion, exchange gold bullion for crude, the crude oil market would collapse. You can't reprice energy in a hard currency. So it winds up that the dollar is a very convenient instrument. It suits everybody's purposes, even the seller. The seller is being paid in dollars that it reasons logically will be worth nothing at some point, but they're taking in enough of those dollars that it leaves them enough margin. The margins on the energy they sell are sufficient that all the sellers, every one of their princely sons has Lamborghinis in 12 different colors. So it's working. The dollar is working for everybody, whether or not a few curmudgeonly sovereign entities are purporting to be against it.
What are the factors that control where the U.S. dollar goes in value?
Well, I think it's easier to start with the premise that the dollar, it really is worthless. And its value in terms of its purchasing power is just sort of a conceit. It's variable. It's how we operate. And, you know, what you can exchange a dollar for will vary over time. And it's not doing too badly now relative. It's really, think of the dollar as a claim on U.S. productivity. It is, as I mentioned earlier, just a debt instrument. The dollar is an IOU. There's nothing behind it. So, but we're basically pledging to pay in law what the C.V. Myers used to call lawful money, you know, whatever that is. So really, the dollar has value because whoever is taking dollars in payment for goods and services trusts that somehow we'll be able to pay it back.
Is the U.S. dollar in a short squeeze? And if it is, where do you see the U.S. dollar going in 2025?
Well, I raised this point maybe 30 years ago with because my background is trading. I used to work on the exchange floor as an options dealer, and it struck me that the dollar could be subject to short squeeze. Everybody who is borrowed, everybody who owes dollars on a mortgage or whatever, is technically short dollars. They borrow dollars with the intention and legal obligation to pay them back in the future. And of course, if the value of the dollar rises, then all people who owe dollars will be squeezed to pay up in dollars that are dearer, that are more valuable, more costly. So that's the mechanism of the short squeeze. And as you've seen that play out in the stock market with these Robin Hoodies or whoever these adolescents are who gave up video games and decided it was more interesting and lucrative to play video games with exchange traded instruments. So they, so you can trade up a storm with these things, and it really, you can see where the end game goes. There's no way out. So you reach a point where people are scrambling. Let's say there were some little banking crisis. We wouldn't line up like we did in 1929 after the crash, because the branches only hold probably $20,000 to $30,000. Yeah, so if there's 10 people waiting in line to get their money out of the bank, at least 9 of them are going to be disappointed. So a short squeeze on a dollar, and I ran this by two professors who'd written a book called The Incredible Euro Dollar, and then I kind of pushed the question with finance professors at some of our better universities, and none of them knew what I was talking about. You know, the whole idea, the concept of a short squeeze is something a trader would be familiar with, but an egghead would have no knowledge of it at all. But when something gets scarce and people have to pay up, we reach a point where the banks are having their problems overnight, and it creates a run on the banks. And all of a sudden, the clearing system that handles money market funds, essentially the overarching administrative apparatus, when it freezes up, a lot of short-term paper that rolls will no longer roll. The whole clearing network will be destroyed if even one small link gets pulled out of it. And what that means is that very, very short-term loans typically settle overnight. They won't be able to settle, that you won't be able to roll them. You'll have to settle in cash. So there'll be this huge demand for cash because you can't borrow anymore to roll your loans. You can't keep the loan kind of going in perpetuity. So that would put a short squeeze on a dollar. Everybody would have to get their hands on real cash dollars because their creditors have basically said, nope, we can't keep rolling these loans. So then, just as you saw in Hertz Car and GameStop, two companies that had no right to even survive, they got bid up to the moon, not because of, there was any quality or value in the companies, but simply because there was this mechanically induced demand for the shares. People had shorted both stocks up the wazoo, and they, with the stocks going crazy, they had to buy the stock to settle their, you know, to replace the stock they'd borrowed. So that's a short squeeze, and it doesn't necessarily imply that the instrument that's being bid up to the moon is worth anything, but it can become valued as though it's worth its weight in gold.
Do digital products allow manufacturers to make products that become obsolete within a period of time? For instance, cell phones, where at a certain point they're no longer able to function properly, and we're talking Android here.
Well, that's a theme that Charles Hugh Smith just took up. He's like the best blogger out there. He just he's written on so many interesting things so insightfully, and his idea is that the whole digital thing could destroy us. And he talks about the planned obsolescence of so much of what we buy, and it's washing machines and cars and everything. And as they increasingly become made in ways, if you've got an old Model A Ford, you can still get parts for it, and they're still out there running. There's a whole bunch of them out there. But if you have a recent vintage LG washing machine or something like that, there's a motherboard in it, a circuit board with microchips and little computers on a board. And they don't make replacement parts there. They can't stock those boards. It would take them so much money to make them and stock them that they allow your washing machine, your newer model, to go out of date, to become obsolete. And this is going to happen with everything. The car, Tesla's a little bit better about it now, about saying, well, if you've got this chip that serves this function in the car, we keep it in stock for X number of years. But even Tesla's not going to keep those chips around forever. And when you can no longer get the chip, your washing machine or your car becomes a big paperweight. And of course, even there, you have additional problems of what to do. It costs a lot of money just to retire something like that to a landfill. So pretty much everything we make these days that has a chip in it is going to be a paperweight at some point. And because we're no longer recycling things, big things, it's going to strain our resources. Because every washing machine, just to even melt a washing machine to get the metal to make a new one, we don't have the resources, the energy, the raw materials to do that. So eventually you run out of the building blocks of everything. You can't build anything because you don't have the power and the metal to do it. So and I don't have to tell you about planned obsolescence. Just look around you. Everything you own, everything that works now, it's only going to work for so long. And I think Charles mentioned Pyrex, but Pyrex, of course, is a very useful thing. We can put it in the oven. And but now Pyrex cracks. It's because old Pyrex is made in China, and of course they'll put you never know what they're putting in, even in baby formula. So if they're putting polyvinyl chloride in baby formula, you can imagine what they're putting in Pyrex glass. So in order to get the Pyrex that doesn't crack, you got to go to a flea market and get a Pyrex measuring cup or casserole dish or something like that that was made in the 1950s or 60s or even earlier. So watch out for all that nice looking blue Pyrex.
Could on-time optimization become a concern for civilization?
Yeah, that's another thing that Charles has written on brilliantly. He takes Everything's optimized. I think he mentioned that pretty much every chicken in every Walmart comes from the same bird processor. And even though that's a very efficient way to do business, to have to grow, to hatch all your birds in one place and ship them out from there, one little wrinkle in the distribution system will destroy the whole thing. And of course, so many of the things we buy are on supply chains that are optimized, that are, nobody carries any inventory anymore. And of course, that's even true for some of the parts that run our big power plants. If something were to go down, if the grid were to get fried in some way, just replacing a lot of the components of a power system, it's not like we stock the spare parts. The country would be without power for long enough that the country would cease to exist, at least as the United States of America. In any case, when efficiency is your only goal, your benchmark, and you wring out all of the inefficiencies, you create a supply chain that's fundamentally, it's unstable. It just takes, it's running very efficiently, but the downside is that it cannot withstand just a little bit of disturbance, a little bit of whatever would put it out of order temporarily, because temporarily is going to wind up being permanently. So everything we make is really, and our systems, it's not just goods and services, but it's just pretty much everything in America has been optimized to death, and none of it is built to withstand just a little bit of stress.
Getting back to Pyrex, is it exploding, and what's that all about?
Yeah, it cracks into 10,000 pieces if you put it in the microwave or the oven. I haven't experienced that myself, probably because all my Pyrex measuring cups are old. So is my Revereware, which I don't know. I guess anyway, yeah, I've got old stuff, so I haven't actually seen exploding Pyrex, but it does happen.
Do you think 2025 will be a good year?
Ha ha. We're close to, I've been saying close for 30 years, but things really are crazy, and it's just not going to go on forever. There are some things you can see that are outside of the range of pure financial speculation, such as the Social Security system and Medicare. And you can see where they're going. I'm just speculating when I say, well, the market's going to collapse tomorrow, the sky is going to fall. But that's not the case when you're talking about some of our larger social welfare systems, namely Medicare and Social Security. No situation is conceivable that will allow. We're not going to just smooth over the problem. The problem being that millennials are simply in Gen X and Gen Y and Gen Z. They're just not cutting it. I mean, yeah, that there are some people who haven't been laid off yet in the Silicon Valley who make good salaries, but that's not going to be enough money to pay for the medical care of baby boomers who are more and more of them are going to live to be 100. And of course, the system wasn't conceived for that kind of actuarial strain. So this is something that's happening now, the breakdown of healthcare. And we talked about this the last time we talked, how medicine is starting to quietly triage. You'll get your doctor's appointment will be on a video screen. And that's really just, that's inferior healthcare, period. But it's sort of the first, not hugely visible step on the way to the debasement of the healthcare system and the triaging of certain, healthcare amenities.
Can you tell us about your special offer again and where people can sign up?
RickAckerman.com, just up at the top there, I think it's free trial. And again, no credit card necessary. We do a lot of good real-time trading ideas get exchanged in the room. We've got some pretty good guys in there, like way over my pay grade. One guy, there's some strategies that are popular, such as naked shorting options that you can tune into on a site. Naked shorting options, I know it sounds dangerous, but it's probably the least risky way to play options, because 90% of the people who lose money with options lose because they bought options, not because they were naked short them. So anyway, all the good stuff, a lot of learning opportunities in the chat room. There are two separate rooms. One's called the Coffee House, where the discussion is a little more broad, but just free trial, no credit card necessary, and you'll get the discussion groups, you'll get the actionable touts, the commentary mailed out on Sunday night, and all that.
Rick, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
My pleasure, Jim. I always appreciate the chance to reach out and to your vast audience. So thank you.
My guest has been Rick Ackerman, editor of the newsletter Rick's Picks, his website rickackerman.com. He was speaking to us from so far snow-free South Florida. Coming up, Alan Mark Angel, next on This Week in Money.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com. This Week in Money is archived online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Alan Mark Angel, one of the top realtors in Canada. He has sold more than 4,000 properties. He's located in West Vancouver, British Columbia, and online at theangelgroup.com, theangell group.com. Alan, welcome back to This Week in Money.
Thank you. Very glad to be here.
How are things looking at Angel Hassman for 2025?
Well, I'm very optimistic. We, in the past year and some, we've opened six new offices. So we're Whistler all the way to Kelowna. And those new offices, there's only like four or five guys in each office, but they're growing and growing and growing. And they're now doing 72% of our sales that we did for this past year. So we should have a good year for the Angel Hat, because the sales in West Van, I check out how many, there's less than one sale a realtor, 0.8 sales for a realtor for the whole year. That's it's the worst area in the Lower Mainland.
How was the fourth quarter for sales in Greater Vancouver and 2024 overall?
Well, absolutely sensational. I'm very optimistic. I'll tell you something that I do. I have 14 areas I do, like Abbotsford, Langley, Burnaby, Richmond, all, you know, Squamish, all of them, Whistler, and that. I do 14 areas, and I do them each month. Now, I have West Van, North Van, and Vancouver. I have the stats from 1980-something. All the other areas, I have all the sales, a chart from 1991 with the 12 months of sales. So I take the average over all that time. What's the worst year all that time? What's the best year? At the end of August this year, of the 14 areas, 9 of them were having the worst year they've ever had. So we looked at that state. This was going to be the worst year of all time. 2018 was the worst year. As I said, my stats are in the 80s and 90s. 2018 was the worst year, but it looked like we're going to have a record low sale. But since August, the end of August, so that's it. When I do it each month, the end of December, those 9 areas that were bad, now we only have 4 that are the worst. So in 4 months, then we end up the third worst year. So we went from the worst year to the third worst year in a 4-month period. So I'm optimistic. I think, you know, the market's not going to have to expect it to fly up, but it's definitely turning around, and I credit that to what's gone on in the States, with the company in the States. The attitude of people has just changed. I'll give you an example. I have a $6 million apartment, and I I've had it for sale a couple of times at the end of the year, and I had like two people come. That's it. Sit there for 2 hours for two people. I had an open last weekend. I had 16 groups. I've never had 16 groups for department open in my life. The attitude was so different. So even though it was the third worst year overall, but in 4 months, how it can go from being the worst to the third worst, and five areas turned around to do that, you know, to not be the worst. So it makes me feeling very positive about the year. And not that I'm expecting, you know, prices to fly up, but it's going to be stronger and we're going to get some more sales. But I cannot believe that 9 of 14 had the worst in, you know, since 1991 or in the 80s. So yes, I'm very optimistic about the year.
Are clusters of condo towers being built in parts of Greater Vancouver increasing the sales numbers?
Well, I do apartments too, and it's strange because, as I just told you, the houses are just, they've been horrible. Third worst year, but apartments, I do Greater Vancouver, West End, and North End, you know, downtown and things like that. All the apartments are not like the houses. They're selling above average. Like the houses have been selling below the worst year. I look at Greater Van apartments. The average year is 12,400 and something. The worst year was 6,034. We had over 13,000 sales. West Van was the same thing. North Van, Lower Lonsdale, I do. So apartment sales are strong. Now, the trouble with the pre-sales, they're not selling because we do some pre-sales. We have some apartments out in the White Rock area. And the old days, you used to buy a pre-sale and make, you know, anyway, depending on if you're in West Van, you could make $1 million on it, $500,000. But now, the last couple of years, you can't. But pre-sales are obviously helping keep the apartment market up because it hasn't crashed like the housing market.
How are West Vancouver waterfront properties selling?
Well, I've sold more waterfronts in West Van than anybody. My partner and I, if you add him on the list, the two of us have sold more than all the other realtors combined. But apartment sales, well, 2024, I have apartment sales charts from 1988. 2024 sales were 5. The average from 1988 is 17. So 5 was the worst year of all time. So, but I took the average took the average for 20 years, 22 for the first 20 years from 88 on, and then I took the average from 2008 to 24. 11 is the average, and we had 5. So it isn't great.
How are high-end West Vancouver properties selling?
Well, it's basically the same thing. It's, I'll just let me get my list there for you. Okay. Here I had it here. No, now it's gone. Well, here it, okay, so if you take over 10 million in West Van, we had 7. The average per year is 5. So but that goes back a long time. So if you take we had 7 last year. Now it's interesting. If you take from 5 million on, we've had 819 from 215 in 10 years, 8 million 181, 10 million 80 sales for 10 million in 10 years, and then 7 for 24. Now, Vancouver West over 10, it's interesting. Last year, in the last 10 years, they've averaged 18.5 sales a year. Last year, they had 13. So it's interesting to me that there are twice as many as ours, but West Van's a small area. So it's okay, but it's not, I mean, it's slow. It is slow for sure.
How is the condo market doing, and especially high-end condos?
Well, as I said, the condo market's been very good. Every area is above an average year. Every area I do is above an average year. So the condo market, the prices haven't changed all that much. Nothing's happened. They're just above average, but they're not, you know, sensational. But the condo market, it's holding its own. It's hard to believe because as I say, the housing market's been so bad. If you take the housing market from 2018, the worst year was 2018. So last 7 years, we've had the five worst years all time. Five worst years in history since I've been a realtor since 2018. Now, I have to look at common things. We had to look who was in power with the NDP here. We had Trudeau in all of Canada. The government certainly plays a part in our market at all. I mean, three times in our market, in my career, the market basically crashed. And it's all because of the government does and the banks do. But there's going to be a change in the change in the attitudes there. And I can tell the year is going to improve. I'm not expecting great jumps or anything, but I think it's going to improve. The condo market should stay fine.
New BC property tax assessments are now out. The assessments are based on July 1st, 2024 prices. How are home prices now compared to July 1st, 2024?
Well, as I said, they look like they're going to be awful because I do comparables. I do an appraisal on a house. I always look at what the BC assessments are on it. Now, in 2018 to about 2020, 2021, we were selling 82% of our houses below BC assessments. Then they have now the assessments dropped. Now they got above assessments again. But right now, it's basically we're selling below assessments again for last year.
In the new BC property tax assessments for some homes, the actual housing structure has risen in price by hundreds of thousands of dollars with no new improvements. Is there an explanation for this other than a tax grab?
Well, the government. I'm not a fan of the government. I think they're the most corrupt corporation, any corporation in Canada. And states, look what's going on in the states with Biden in there. That's the same thing. So, they need the money. And we don't know where it goes. And I think we need someone to look at our government here too, to just like they're going to do in the states, because most of it makes no sense at all. I try to avoid the government all I can.
The Bank of Canada rate now is 3.25%. Are the banks making it tough to get mortgages?
Well, it has been tough. It's been very tough the last while. But it's starting to, because the rates have dropped a bit and the attitude's dropped, I think you're going to find more sales. But you're right. It's, what worries me, one of the problems is when the rates went down to 0.5%, everybody could borrow money off the family and buy a house. But when those houses come up for renewal and the rates are going to 3.5, but at least it's lower than 5%. So it'll be a problem for sure.
How leveraged are people when buying real estate, especially high-end homes?
Well, the high-end home has never been a problem. They normally put 50% down. And so it really it is. And the people who can afford it. See, the high-end homes are so much. I mean, I just put a house down on the market in California, 20 minutes from Rodeo Drive, Beverly Hills, at that, and $17 million. That house, if that was here, would sell for $25 million at least. I cannot understand, and Hawaii is the same way. I have a place there. It amazes me how much we have to pay for our houses here. I mean, Canada's a nice place. Vancouver's great, but really, when it's more expensive than houses by Beverly Hills, it makes no sense to me. No sense to me at all. Canada, I mean, it's nice, it's beautiful, but really, I like going to Hawaii. I like going to Palm Desert area. So they're more expensive here than they are down here, which really concerns me. But that's one of the reasons we opened a new office, because when you look at the houses, how much? I mean, I remember I sold a house for Jimmy Pallas, and right next door to his big house. He owned the one there. I sold him in the 70s. I sold it for like $76,000, and it was an old house then. But I remember Jimmy said to me, "Mr. Angel, you're going to be a very successful realtor." Now, he won't remember that, but when a guy like you're in your 20s and Jimmy Pattison says that to you, you don't forget that. But anyway, just 3 years ago, the couple that bought it, he passed away. She wanted to sell it. She wouldn't let me in the house because basically it was a teardown. But I sold the lot for $7 million. And it was 76,000 then. So, I mean, and then you have to build a whole new house on it. So, price, I mean, it's just... that's just too expensive. That's why we expanded out to Port Moody, you know, Abbotsford, White Rock, Langley. You can still buy million-dollar houses there, but how do you buy a house in West Vancouver when the lot's $7 million? It's up in the province. It isn't on the water. It's a great view, but it's way too much. I had a house I sold for $6 million. They rented the house out, and they got $25,000 a month rent for the house, which was shocking. I said to the couple, God, you guys make $800,000 a year. It was a doctor and lawyer. You can't afford to buy as well. We'd have to put $3 million down. We can't save $3 million. So here's a couple with $800,000 a year salary, and they can't save $3 million. So it's just, and then the young people, I just sold a little apartment in North Van, 822 square feet. And I sold it for $1,000,050. Okay, but they rented it for $4,400 for 820 square feet. Even the rents are getting insane. But that's the one of the reasons we took a gamble opening the new office, is because there was no money to be made in West Van. It was the first time ever we were losing money. When you think of it, there's 775 reals in West Vancouver, and we sold less than 700 houses and apartments. So it's tough. And there's hardly any one company offices anymore. We had to expand, and it worked out for us. So it's great, but you got to find some way to get. I remember when I bought my first house, it was $44,000. I had to get $5,000. My parents let me $5,000. But nowadays, $5,000 is not going to get you anything but a toothbrush. So, I mean, it's how it is. You have to find a way to get your kids into a house because, you think my first waterfront sale was $110,000 in the same street, it's only block line. We've had two sales on there, 30 and 32. Five on that way. One of them we just put back on for $58 million. So my career houses have gone from 110 on the same long block street, West Van, to they're asking 58, which is an insane price.
Have a number of high end listings been pulled that will likely be back for the spring market as new listings with new lower pricing?
Well, basically, what happens when November the first? I like November as a month. And one of the reasons I do like it is because about 25% of our houses come off the market. It doesn't matter whether they're high end or low end, they come off the market. So there's two things about November, December. I remember I had a huge oceanfront. I had 257 feet on the water. And in fact, the Canucks would come. I put a driving about 80,000 golf balls, and the Canucks came and hit the balls in the ocean, but because they were all my clients. But, it has changed what is going on, but I don't think there's any more houses than anywhere high end houses, not more come off than the average houses. When I look at right now, if you look at the high end, we had seven sales. There's 40 on the market right now. Seven sales. There'll probably be by springtime 55 on the market. In Vancouver, there was 13 sold last year. There's 58 on the market. It'll be 75 at least by the springtime. But that's the same with all the housing. Everybody thinks, well, I'll take it off and won't sell. But as I tell people, look, if a buyer comes to see your house in November or December, boom, they're buyers. My own oceanfront I sold it. And first year didn't sell. And then finally, I left it on November, December. On December 19th, a hockey player from New York called, came in and bought my house. December the 19th. So the people who look at your house November, December are buyers for sure. They're not looking unless they're going to buy. So I like it when 25 to 30% come off the market. There's fewer houses to choose from.
Is the BC NDP flipping tax likely have an effect on high-end homes?
Well, I can't think of the last house that I thought was flipped. Doesn't seem that. The market hasn't been strong enough. You think that. In the last, since 2018, we've had the five worst years. So there hasn't been people buying to flip houses. You just don't see it because it was just about impossible to do that. So I don't think the taxes are going to be an issue at all.
Is Vancouver still one of the biggest real estate bubbles in the world?
Well, as I said, it's more expensive here than it is in a Rodeo Drive area and in Honolulu. So, yes, it is.
Are offshore owners motivated to sell properties?
Well, it's changed immensely. We have three cultures here. We have the Caucasians, the Europeans, whatever, the Chinese, the Persians, and that. And basically, 3-4 years ago, when I look at West Bank, it was just about the same, one-third, one-third, and one-third for buyers. Now Caucasians are 52% last year, and most of the high ends are Caucasian buyers, and they never were. It was the Chinese, the Iranians buying. The Chinese would buy the houses, the Iranians would buy the waterfront apartments. But it's starting to change. The Chinese would never sell. My biggest Chinese client had 32 houses. She didn't want to sell any of them. She's now started to sell them. So a lot of the listings now are owned by Chinese. They wouldn't sell. Now they're like everybody else. They want to sell.
How is the inventory and sales to listings ratios for high-end homes?
Well, as I say, the last couple of years, we've had, I look back at the high-end houses, expensive homes, and it used to be a huge amount of sales. But now we're down, same as the ocean fronts. There were years we sold 29, 28, 25 on the ocean fronts. The last few years, it's been like 7, 7, 7, 7, 6, 5. So it's changed. It's changed all that. There aren't as many people buying them because, let's face it, they're a lot more than they used to be.
Some people are saying home prices will rise this year. What do you think is likely?
Well, I probably won't know till March, but I know the market has changed. Okay, so I'm optimistic. But there's still, the prices are so high, the interest rates are higher, so I don't expect it. There could be. I'm hoping prices will stay the same. They may go up a touch, 4 or 5%. That's what I'm expecting.
What is privacy protection and why is it bad?
Well, privacy protection was put in, and I'm not a fan of privacy protection, basically means that no other realtor can go. So what the realtors say, okay, you want other realtors calling you about your house? Well, absolutely not. So they tick the privacy protection box. Okay, because they don't want to be bothered by the other realtors. And that was put in there because when the house expires, you get a lot of people that call you because of expiry. But I look at houses, I check expiries all the time. And I can tell you, I see houses that I know I could sell that house because it just fits in my client base. I know I could sell the house, no question. But I can't call that person no matter how long. So even if the house expires, they expired in June last year. I can never call them. And when you're sitting here, if you're really not, you don't want the normal, most times realtors are called the very average realtor. But the top guys look, three or four top guys, they know they can sell everything. And when you look at a house that I may have sold before or I've seen it, showed it, I know I can sell it, but I can't phone them. So basically, the trouble with our business, you decide to list your house today. All right. My neighbor's son just started, or daughter just started, or I have a family member just started. So I better give him or her a try straight off. Well, probably won't sell because it's like our business is like anything. If I'm sick, I want the best doctor. Get sued, I want the best lawyer, the best realtor, the best. When I was at my prime, I sold 18% of all the houses in West Van for a few years. So you want the best, but sometimes all realtors claim that they're the best. I remember there was a big billboard as you left West Vancouver, and it said top salesman in West Van. Well, I knew the guy. He was successful, but he was top in his office. That was a far cry from being the top realtor there. He had misleading advertising all the time. But there's a lot of good realtors out there. And, there's probably three really successful realtors, two or three good ones, and all the rest. But the good ones who know they can sell you house can't call you. I just put a house on the market that was privacy protected. It was an apartment. And I didn't, they called me. I didn't even know the apartment was on the market. And they called me and they said, Mr. Andrew, well, the lake, you can come up and talk about selling our apartment. Well, then I looked at it as privacy protected. Now, I couldn't have called them, but if they called the realtor, no problem. But I think it stops, the reason I don't like it, I think it stops you getting a chance to get the best realtors calling you to get your home sold. And I hate that. It's like this DEI thing that we've been talking about. I think everybody should be entitled to get the best person they can for that particular job. And so when I looked, I'm thinking, I did it was last week. I saw two. I said, I could sell both of these houses. No question. I mean, I got to, you know, until it's on the market, you don't. Because I may not have a buyer today, but I know my people that will call me, because the houses I got, one of them will call me that maybe wants that house. So the privacy protection, if you tick that in the box, that means even though your house is on for 6 months, nobody can call you forever and ever. So it stops those bad ones calling and bothering you. But I would rather not tick the box and have a chance for one of the really successful realtors calling you to get the house.
What do you think the spring market is likely to look like?
I think you're going to have another probably 20-25% houses on the market. And I'm optimistic. I haven't been as optimistic as this in years. So I'm optimistic. I'm hoping the market's going to turn around. And we're going to get more. I mean, the average in West Van is 707 sales is the average. We had 397 this year. In 2018, we had 321. I'm counting both houses and apartments. 321, 397. Then the second worst, like, was 344 or something. So we're selling in the threes, and the average is 707. The best market ever in West Van was over 1,200. If you take Richmond and Vancouver, the best year they've ever had is in the 2800s. They're nowhere near it. The second best they've ever had is 2,200. So none of these areas have got back or close to the best of all time, or even, you know, sizably above the average. The market has just changed. It's softened, but it's time that it starts to change.
Currently, is real estate in a buyer's market or a seller's market?
Well, I think it's right now. I think I'd call it. I mean, it has been you've had to sell. If you want, I told people to sell, but now I think the buyers ought to be buying, because I think, see, most buyers say, well, we're going to live here 10 to 15 years. If you're only going to live here for 2 years, no, I wouldn't buy. I'd wait to make sure it's changed. But if you're going to live there, then I would be buying now for sure, because I think it's going to be a stable year.
Alan, where can people follow you and contact you?
Well, Angel Hasman is the name of my company. Alan Angel, Malcolm Hasman, my partner. Angel, A-N-G-E-L-L, and Hasman is H-E-S-M-A-N. Now, we sell houses all over the place. We just sold one in Port Moody not too long, for over $6 million in Port Moody. I never thought that would ever happen at any time. So it doesn't matter where your house is. Give me a call, and if I can handle it, I will. If not, because my offices, we get the top realtors calling us to join the firm, because we're the biggest high-end company there is, and so every realtor wants to be in the high-end. So my realtors are very, very successful. My Port Moody office, Port Moody, is my top realtors been in Port Moody for 2 years. The top team's been in Port Moody. I would never have expected that. So I have great people all over. At Whistler office, it's been in business since Christmas last year. This was our first year. We're the number two office in Worcester this year, in our first year. So, you know, it's only a matter of time before we're at the top. So our company is, and that's the high end is special, but I don't care. My last sale was $1,050,000. I'm putting an apartment on in the 800s. I don't care, but I haven't got time to drive for hours and hours, so I'll either do it myself or I will work with somebody else, one of the people in my office. We just did a deal in Kelowna. We opened an office there, and I have a lot of clients who live in Kelowna. They call me, so I work with one of the realtors there. So my phone number is easy, 778-888-7474, 888-7474, and I'm a chatty Cathy. I love to talk to people.
Alan, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Thanks, Jim. I'll talk to you soon.
My guest has been Alan Mark Angel, one of the top realtors in Canada. He's located in West Vancouver, BC. his website, theangelgroup.com. And that wraps up our show for this week. We'd like to thank our guests, Ross Clark, Rick Ackerman, and Alan Mark Angel. And thank you for listening. If you have any questions for the show or our guests, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. I'm Jim Goddard. We'll be back next week with more This Week in Money.
Comments made on This Week in Money are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. This Week in Money is a production of How Street Media Incorporated. Executive producer is Tom Allen.